This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Millions of people have another shot at health insurance this year, an update to housing discrimination rules, and a look at what swimming pools can teach us about racism in the U.S. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, February 15th. Good to have you with us. A lot of people's situations have changed in the pandemic. So the federal government is giving people an extra chance to adjust their health care coverage. Today is the first day of a new open enrollment period on healthcare.gov, the federally run Affordable Care Act marketplace that serves 36 states. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the details.
Over the last 4 years, the Trump administration has slashed the marketing and outreach budget to get people enrolled in Obamacare. The result? Enrollment is down. Jennifer Haley has been monitoring that trend at the Urban Institute.
They also cut funding to provide assistance with enrollment, such as for health insurance navigators, who can be really instrumental in helping people learn about coverage options and navigate enrollment processes.
In all, the Kaiser Family Foundation estimates there are 15 million currently uninsured people who are eligible for free or low-cost coverage with subsidies. Cynthia Cox, vice president of the foundation's Affordable Care Act program, has been looking into who is being left behind.
They tend to be more likely to be Hispanic, more likely to be Spanish-speaking, more likely to work in fields like construction or arts or entertainment, where there often isn't health coverage offered. And they also tend to be younger adults.
To reach those people, the Biden administration plans to spend $50 million on marketing this time around during the three-month enrollment period. Peter Lee, who heads California's state-run exchange, says marketing works. The state spends tens of millions of dollars a year to get people to sign up.
We're at more people enrolled than we've ever had before. That's what you want in the middle of a pandemic.
In addition, Lee says having more people enrolled has in fact lowered costs for consumers. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Another move by the new administration, updating housing rules to protect people from being discriminated against because they are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
For the first time, LGBTQ people are now protected from housing discrimination under federal law.
This is a very big deal.
Jake Lillian is an attorney with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
We've been waiting a long time for the day when someone could contact HUD and say, I've been the victim of housing discrimination because I'm gay or because I'm trans.
Now they can, Lillian says, and have their claim taken seriously.
And there is a hope that housing providers will now know that they cannot get away with blatant discrimination.
Whether they're renting or selling a home. Sherita Gruberg at the Center for American Progress says the protections go beyond that, too.
The Fair Housing Act also prohibits mortgage and lending discrimination for housing. It prohibits shelter discrimination.
Some states already prohibited housing discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, but 21 did not.
And we know that LGBTQ people are less likely to own homes, are more likely to experience homelessness, and face significant levels of discrimination in housing.
transgender people in particular, which is why HUD's move to extend fair housing protections is so significant, Gruberg says.
But the last administration really demonstrated how easily a anti-LGBTQ government can rescind protections.
Which is why she'd also like to see Congress pass the Equality Act and enshrine those protections into law permanently. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Markets were closed on this federal holiday, so a different look at the markets. Retail details when we do the numbers. When it comes to smartphones and other smart devices, sure, as the ubiquitous branding tells us, there's an app for that. But now there are apps for all the apps, so-called super apps. They are already popular in Asia and are changing how people live and work. The BBC's Karishma Vaswani has this report.
Singaporean entrepreneurs Angeline Liu and Angie Teng set up a business 3 years ago selling premium meat to Chinese customers. They've never advertised. They don't use social media. All they do use to get more customers is something called WeChat, as Angeline explains.
So WeChat is this part of our daily life that basically right now we won't be able to live without. It's an app that has integrated most of the daily functions that we need. It's as if for most people running their life without Instagram plus YouTube plus Facebook plus WhatsApp plus Twitter probably.
Typically, people use separate apps for banking, shopping, food delivery and chatting to friends. But imagine if you had one app that did all of that. That is a super app. Has dominated the super app world, and there are really only two big super apps that everyone uses there, Tencent's WeChat and rival Ant Group's Alipay, both with almost a billion users.
Some Chinese companies are so dominant in their specific markets. For a lot of Chinese users, actually, they simply just don't have the alternative. They have to use these apps.
Ray Ma is co-host of the Tech Buzz podcast. She points out that one of the reasons China's been so successful at super apps is that there's no foreign competition allowed, and data laws are very different.
In the West, we have a lot of rules and regulations and laws creating a lot of friction around these services that in China, the government simply hasn't gotten around to regulating. Finally, you have the fact that actually Chinese internet companies really think of building entire ecosystems versus product-first or product-centric companies. So they're not really thinking of just building a feature or one service. They're thinking about how to take the user's entire lifestyle and moving it online.
A life lived entirely online means a lot of transactions and a lot of data. Under Chinese law, all companies, not just WeChat, can be compelled to hand over that data to the Communist Party. And that raises the risk of censorship of content, something that the Australian Strategic Policy Institute says is already happening in China and could potentially happen overseas. Tencent, the Chinese company that owns WeChat, told the BBC that its policies and procedures comply with the laws and regulations of each market it operates in, adding that user privacy and data security are core values. That's perhaps a reason why it's been so difficult for these Chinese apps to expand abroad. The domestic mainland Chinese market is so big, there's also really no need to go anywhere else. But some Western firms and startups in Southeast Asia are now trying to replicate their success using partnerships to get round regulations. And with a market of 600 million people across the Asia-Pacific region, the race to build the world's next super app is fast revving up. In Singapore, I'm the BBC's Karishma Vaswani for Marketplace.
A quick reminder, you can start your morning with what you need to know about what's happening in the economy all over the world. Listen to the Marketplace Morning Report. The nationwide protests following the police killing of George Floyd amplified the conversation about systemic racism and inequality in this country. And later that fall, Citigroup released a report estimating that the U.S. failure to address the racial wealth gap between Black and white Americans cost $16 trillion over just the last two decades. But dollars are just one way of measuring the economic damage of racism. It also shows up in what kind of infrastructure, services, and benefits become public goods, the nature of the social contract between government and its citizens. Heather McGee is a distinguished senior fellow at the progressive think tank Demos and is the author of the new book called The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Heather, welcome to the program.
So glad to be with you.
In the beginning of your book, you make it very clear that your focus is on how racism affects everybody, including and maybe especially white Americans. Why that distinction?
One of the main drivers of racist thinking is a zero-sum worldview, the idea that progress for one racial group has to come at the expense of the other. That is faulty thinking. There's an economic benefit to narrowing and closing the gaps. But it's also part of the thinking that we promulgate when we only talk about the advantages of racism to white people. Ultimately, racism has a cost for everyone.
I wonder how you think this is going to play in the broader conversation that we're having in this country about racial justice and economic inequality that in many ways is trying to decenter white people.
I think it's important to widen the aperture. We talk about the benefits of systemic racism to white people, and I know those benefits are real, right? We think about the way white people have better access to healthcare, to better schools. They are able to not fear the police. I don't believe that racism particularly or especially hurts white people. In fact, I take pains to say that racism always hits the targets first and worst, but there are often spillover effects on white communities. The story at the heart of my book is the story of when towns in the 1950s and 60s drained their public swimming pools rather than integrate them. Of course, that meant that white families lost out, but Black families never got the kind of richly funded public amenities that were the hallmark of the pre-integration era.
The story about the fairground pool, as somebody who grew up in St. Louis, was absolutely new to me. And I spent a not small chunk of this morning calling my sister, my mother, my grandmother, and multiple elders trying to find anyone who knew about this lavish pool that held thousands of people and had a sandy beach and was the scene of this, you know, mob attack. And it took me 6 or 7 phone calls before the mother of one of my friends who grew up in St. Louis even had a recollection of this and vaguely remembered seeing a photo of something that she thought was that event. And that's a key theme in your book about what and how we remember our history shapes our policies today.
Kimberly, I'm blown away by that. You're right. Where racism drained the pool, there aren't plaques or markers to remind us of this. And that's why we feel doomed to repeat it, to repeat what ultimately is a withdrawal by a white population that's been taught to disdain and distrust people of color from the kinds of public benefits and public goods that benefit us all.
You also write about places where overcoming racism has led to positive responses and where communities have found a way to kind of move away from this zero-sum mentality. You specifically point to a town in Maine where Somali refugees helped improve the local economy. What did you find there?
Maine is the whitest and oldest state in the union. I went to what's often referred to as a dying mill town called Lewiston, where the main street had really come alive again because of refugees from Africa. So these are Black, Muslim, immigrants, right? This is the entire trifecta of scapegoated and demonized individuals. And yet I talked to white Mainers who were willing to reject racist and xenophobic stereotypes and just sort of roll up their sleeves and remake their town together.
How easy is that Lewiston success to replicate elsewhere?
In some ways, it's always a fight, because even in Lewiston, where we saw those great signs of growth and collaboration, the local mayor had been anti-immigrant, the governor had been very racist and anti-immigrant. And so there's always this pressure, as one of the shopkeepers that I spoke to said, when election day comes, the knives come out. It's this idea that it's really politics that helps drive this division, and that ultimately we all want the same things, to meet our basic needs and fulfill our dreams. And racism is a tool that divides us from the collective action that we need to ensure a decent quality of life for everyone.
Heather McGee is a distinguished senior fellow at Demos. Her new book is The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The book and audiobook out tomorrow, and you can find an excerpt with more on that swimming pool story on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up,
you can get caricatures, you can get record sleeve puzzles.
Decisions, decisions. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed today. President's Day weekend is often a time when companies offer sales on big-ticket items like cars. Auto sales finished better than some had predicted overall last year, given the pandemic. Cox Automotive says total sales in 2020 were about 14.5 million. That's down 15% from the year before, 2019. But it's not as bad as things were looking at the start of the pandemic. Pandemic gardening is a thing, and although it may still be wintry and cold where you are, this is the time when seed sales start to ramp up. In 2017, the USDA estimated that for every dollar spent on seeds and fertilizers, home gardeners can grow an average of $25 worth of produce. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. The city of Nashville is famous for music and music museums. The Country Music Hall of Fame, Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, Musicians Hall of Fame, and now the National Museum of African American Music. Colleen Phelps has this look inside.
On a Saturday afternoon, the brand new National Museum of African American Music is bustling in downtown Nashville, even though it's only allowed 50% capacity. The masks, temperature checks, and timed entry are actually the most low-tech part of the visit. Every room of the museum has an interactive experience tied to a specific type of music. This is a family singing along with a choir in an experience led by gospel music celebrity Dr. Bobby Jones. Thanks to a green screen, 10-year-old Carisse Daughtry can actually see herself in the choir.
Yeah, it was very fun.
And that's early in the walk through the museum, before guests build a jazz improvisation, write a blues song, and layer samples together. In a small studio, visitors can freestyle a rap with a sample song. Then, with a swipe of a smart wristband, a link to all of their creations goes to their email. So it didn't take long for these to make their way on social media. Here, TikTok user Joynette's raps along with Nicki Minaj.
This one's for the boys with the Bowman system. Top down AC with the coolest.
Opening the museum has been a journey for the city. Its founders crafted a vision for the institution in 1998, and a site was first designated in 2002. But fundraising slowed things down, and the vision narrowed.
The original name for the museum was the Museum of African American Music, Art, and Culture.
That's CEO H. Beecher Hicks. He says just focusing on music made the museum a better fit for Nashville's brand of Music City, making it more likely to draw tourists who are already here. The original site was abandoned due to lack of funds, but eventually, with some pressure from City Hall, the $60 million venue was built on Nashville's former convention center site. As design and construction began, the institution started to offer off-site community programming at schools and for corporate groups. In 2020, this moved online due to COVID-19. As a result, the museum has archived interviews with luminaries like jazz icon Dee Dee Bridgewater and Supremes member, the late Mary Wilson. An educational series called From Nothing to Something documents how, despite limited resources, Black musicians found ways to use the materials that were available, as Spoons virtuoso Lucius Talley explains.
The spoons, just like any other instrument.
But there are some things visitors can only experience in person with a ticket that costs just under $25 for adults. Like learning how to dance the twist, disco, and popping and locking, all with an infrared instructor. The exhibits cover over 50 genres of music. As CEO Hicks points out, that music also influenced decor and fashion.
Music is not just a genre, it's really how we live.
At the moment, at least through February, the museum is open on weekends. In Nashville, I'm Colleen Phelps for Marketplace.
Much of the world has been in and out of lockdown for almost a year now, and many of us have discovered, or rediscovered, things that are just more fun to do when you don't have the option to go out, like jigsaw puzzles, which leads us to our latest installment of our series, My Economy, this one from our partners at the BBC.
My name is Julie Wilkins, and I'm a director with my partner, Brian Knight, of JHG Jigsaws Limited. Neither of us had a puzzle background. I was a bank manager, Brian was a builder. And then when I left the bank, I went and worked for a gentleman who had his own jigsaw puzzle company and enjoyed it so much we set up our own, bought him out with his consent. He was getting on into his 70s, 80s. And then in 2008, we went into manufacturing. I'm very traditional. So I'm selling a lot of nostalgic things like farmyards and street scenes. And I do a lot of what people would call chocolate box cottages. And that seems to be, for me, very popular. There are other companies out there doing other sorts of different things. You can get caricatures, you can get record sleeve puzzles. But generally, for me, my traditional image type puzzles are going the best. We started to see a big increase in sales February, March before lockdown, when COVID was in its infancy last year. And we hit lockdown as we went into Mother's Day. And we normally see an increase for Mother's Day, but it never stopped increasing. Although I know COVID has hit a lot of businesses very hard, it's been very kind to us in the jigsaw world. I think it will slow down, but I think people have suddenly found something that they enjoyed as children, and I think people will have found, rekindled a love for it. I just think they will continue to be popular. I hope they will.
That was Julie Wilkins at JHG Jigsaws Limited in the UK. This series only works with your help. Tell us about your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, or perhaps many, many notes, big news in the music industry over the weekend, as the French conglomerate Vivendi announced it wants to sell off about 60% of Universal Music Group to investors. So traders can now have a piece of the label that represents artists like Ariana Grande, The Weeknd, Blackpink, and Lady Gaga. That's if the current shareholders approve of the plan. Your moment of economic context on this Monday. Before heading out for the holiday weekend, the Biden administration released its plan for how to get as many schools as possible open for in-person learning in the pandemic. That plan notably does not say that teachers have to be vaccinated to reopen schools. Education Week has been tracking just how states are prioritizing teachers in their vaccine rollouts. As of last week, teachers are eligible for vaccines in 28 states here in D.C. and in Puerto Rico. That's, of course, as vaccine supply permits. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.